This is case number A20-1250, George Graham Pooley versus Barbara Lynn Pooley.
And appellant counsel, when you're ready to proceed, please do so.
Thank you, Your Honor. Good morning, and may it please the court. Michael Boulette here on behalf of Barbara Lynn Pooley. Your Honors, Ms. Pooley is before the court today seeking reversal of a district court order which refused to equally apportion the party's marital retirement assets despite explicit language in their judgment and decree requiring them to do so. Now, before the court, we assert three primary errors. The first being that the court failed to apply the unambiguous language of the judgment and decree and instead attempted to construe a document that really required no construction because it spoke for itself. The second error is that that construction itself is an abuse of discretion, having been made not based on the evidence and in violation of settled principles of Minnesota law on equitable division. And our third basis for reversal is the court's failure to apply the omitted asset doctrine, which says that if parties fail to include an asset in their divorce decree, the court retains jurisdiction to equitably divide that asset upon divorce. Now, Your Honor, there is a significant amount of agreement in this case between the district court's order, appellant's brief, and respondent's brief. And the primary basis of that agreement is the party's divorce decree isn't an ambiguous document. It doesn't require construction. Appellant takes the position that the words on the page speak for themselves, that when the parties say we will divide our marital assets equally, that the document means what it says. The district court found in its conclusions of law that this is a document that required no clarification. And respondent's brief also makes the point that the document here is not ambiguous. So we have, on the face of it, a admittedly pro se document, which the parties constructed themselves, which says under marital property in their own handwriting, we'll equally divide our marital assets, we will cooperate. There's not a dispute that the marital retirement Ms. Pooley seeks to divide was accumulated during the marriage. We have $230,000 in defined contribution benefits and an unvalued but presumably substantial pension acquired over that same period of time. So the question becomes, why would the district court fail to equally apportion the marital retirement benefits, which were admittedly marital and were admittedly governed, admittedly marital and which are subject to the judgment and decree?
Mr. Boulette, before you go on, I think we should talk about the premise that the decree is unambiguous. I mean, you're making that argument, but with respect to a particular account and a particular pension asset that are not mentioned anywhere in the decree. And the language, we will split equally, we will work together, appears next to, right above a paragraph that refers to the attached asset sheet listing, which is incorporated into the petition. And that says nothing about the two items, the two assets that you're referring to. So, I mean, I feel like that's not the way we usually use the word unambiguous when we're interpreting a document, whether it's a contract or a statute or otherwise.
I can understand the court's concern, Judge Johnson, and I do think that what everybody acknowledges is this is a better decree under either side's argument if the retirement is included here. From Ms. Pooley's perspective, though, there are really two things the court can do with this language. It can take it on face value that when the document says all of our marital property will be split equally, we will divide, to apply that language to all marital property. And certainly attachment A includes specific items of marital property that are allocated to each person. Ms. Pooley's getting her car, Mr. Pooley's getting his car, but it doesn't include the marital retirement. So on the face of it, we have a document.
Go ahead, finish your answer, I'm sorry.
Oh no, so on the face of it, Your Honor, what we have is a document that has a general provision purporting to govern all marital property and a more specific provision governing certain items of marital property. It's Ms. Pooley's belief, unambiguously, that document tells us what we do with all marital property, unless it's governed by the more specific provisions of attachment A. What we know though, is even if that provision is not, even if the court didn't find the provision to be ambiguous, we have another doctrine that kicks in here. Because what we all know is that what the document doesn't do is unambiguously award Mr. Pooley $230,000 in defined contribution assets and his entire pension. There's no argument before the court that the document unambiguously does that. The only way the court gets to that outcome is by finding ambiguity, which the district court didn't do here and which neither side argued for, and then by interpreting the document based on extrinsic evidence that doesn't support the outcome that it got to. So in order to support the outcome here, there has to be a finding of ambiguity, and then there has to be sufficient extrinsic evidence to link to demonstrate that the parties intended to divest Ms. Pooley of hundreds of thousands of dollars in savings that was accumulated over the course of this 25-year marriage. I can understand, Judge Johnson, your concern that it looks that when we don't call out an asset, we have the potential to create ambiguity. What I would suggest is that when we don't call out an asset and we have a general provision that purports to govern it, applying the unambiguous language of the decree requires us to treat that asset according to the more general language.
But that's a theory. Here's what I'm getting at, Mr. Brulette. You know, what bothers me about divorce decrees, first of all, these parties tried to do it themselves, tried to work without incurring cost. You get to a pension or a retirement account, and the instructions clearly say in the do-it-yourself, fill-in-the-blank paperwork that you have to have a present-day value. Attorneys even struggle with trying to come up with pension present-day values and whatever. And isn't it likely that the omission is because, oh my gosh, we're going to have to incur some cost if we're going to figure that out? That's my one concern. My second concern is we have a trial court judge that made explicit credibility determinations. And anytime on appeal, when you have a trial judge that says, you know, Mr. Pooley was believable and his basis was believable, we have trouble as an appellate court in how we would, how we handle and deal that. And I'd like you to respond to that if you would.
Sure. And I'm going to try to make sure I get to each of your questions in turn, Judge Warkey. First, with respect to the exclusion, doesn't the exclusion tell us something here? Respectfully, I don't think it does. I don't think it does under a strict contract interpretation view, because silence by itself doesn't necessarily create ambiguity. And what I think is particularly key is there is no language, there is no construction that can be applied to the language of this document that reaches the plain language without additional context that reaches the outcome Mr. Pooley advocates for. And what I mean by that is only by adding words and adding terms and adding understanding, as the district court did, that you get to an outcome that in which Mr. Pooley gets 100% of his retirement. There is no way that you can look at the documents on the words on the page, which say, we'll equally divide all our marital property, and which make no mention of allocating Mr. Pooley's retirement to him, that you can take the language in this divorce decree and get to Mr. Pooley, you know, sweeps the field with his retirement. With respect to the credibility determination, Judge Warkey, I'm particularly sensitive to that because I understand you're operating here off of two different standards of review. But the first standard of review, in which you look at the plain language of this document, is a legal question where you are operating de novo. And one of the basic flaws of the district court's error is that it's proceeding to do factual finding about what the parties may have meant, what they thought, who was credible, before it does the initial work of saying, I have an ambiguous decree in front of me, or I have an unambiguous decree in front of me.
Mr. Brulette, isn't it fairly clear that the district court made an implicit finding or implicit determination that it's ambiguous? I mean, I understand there's no explicit statement, but it seems, isn't that obvious from the analysis?
I think it would be obvious, Your Honor, but for some of the language in the court order itself. So I'm looking particularly at provision 2 of the order in our appendix 12 that says the court has determined the judgment decree needs no clarification, which seems to be to point at least strongly a direction of I don't see anything ambiguous here. Both parties said the decree wasn't ambiguous at different point in times. I believe that point was directly put to respondents' counsel, and both parties said we don't see ambiguity in this document. And I think third, even if the court made an implicit determination of ambiguity, that determination itself would be subject to de novo review by this court. Do the words on this page, can the words as the parties wrote them themselves, and understanding, I think, to Judge Warkey's point that these are self-represented parties, right, working themselves on a document provided by the court administrator, can these words reasonably be susceptible to more than one meaning? And there is no other meaning that respondent has offered that make sense of the words on the page. The words on the page provide for a general equitable division. They provide for a specific award of certain assets to each party. There's nothing in those words that a respondent has identified, that's identified in the district court's order, that applies any meaning other than the meaning that's been supplied by appellant. In order to make sense of the document in front of us, we would, in order to find ambiguity and have that finding be an appropriate conclusion of law, there would have had to have been another alternative theory that made an equal amount of sense of the words on the page. And nothing in the words as they've been stated provides for the award to Mr. Pooley of 100% of his retirement. Which brings us to the second point. When the court was confronted with this document, which seems to say everything gets divided equally, but doesn't explicitly mention retirement, rather than function in an ambiguity, non-ambiguity world, rather than deal with this as a matter of textual construction, the answer that this court and the Supreme Court have supplied to district courts is to apply the omitted asset doctrine, to say the parties didn't deal with this asset. They overlooked it, which is particularly common when in pro se divorces. Take that asset, treat it as undivided, and then apply the equitable division theory.
And Mr. Millett, I think now you're referring to your third argument, correct, where you're citing Steele, Searles, and especially Brink. Am I correct?
Correct. Principally the Brink case.
Yeah. So that, and that, I will say that on my first review, that seemed like a case that really could be helpful to you and your client. However, that case was decided before the adoption of Section 518.145, and I don't think Brink has been applied since the adoption of that statute. I mean, isn't it necessary now to go through that statute in order to establish that a decree should be reopened rather than, I mean, otherwise it seems like Brink makes the statute sort of superfluous or meaningless if you can just rely on Brink alone and have it a decree amended. I
would disagree with that, Your Honor. I would point to Fisher, the unpublished case that we cited in both our principal and reply briefs. I, on the top of my head, Your Honor, don't recall if Fisher, which is a 2009 case, explicitly applies Brink, but it certainly applies either Brink or Searles or Steele. It applies the omitted asset doctrine as it's continued to exist. And this court, certainly at the very least in its unpublished case law, has continued to apply the omitted asset doctrine alongside the reopening doctrine in 518.145. And there's been no holding to date that 518.145 subdivision 2 supersedes the omitted asset doctrine, which makes good sense because they truly are intended to right different sorts of wrongs, right? 518.145 in essence provides a Rule 6002 gateway for an attack on a judgment. As the Supreme Court made clear when it adopted the omitted asset doctrine, what the court's really doing when it divides an omitted asset is addressing what has been unaddressed, dealing with issues that have not been dealt with, and so aren't precluded by the finality considerations that 518.145 is designed to govern. Pausing to make sure I've fully answered your question, but I would agree with the court.
Well, you've raised, I mean, these are interesting issues. And I guess when you say when the Supreme Court created or adopted the omitted asset doctrine, you know, I mean, it wasn't quite so explicit, and we didn't get a nice treatise from the Supreme Court. We got one paragraph in Steele, we got a couple sentences in Searles, and so I'm not sure, you know, it could have been that the Supreme Court in those opinions was left unsaid the procedures for how one, I mean, I think that Steele talked about amending the decree, but that leaves unsaid how does one amend the decree? And so I'm not sure if Steele says that you can just snap your fingers and get a decree amended with, you know, for any reason.
And I would agree. The omitted asset doctrine has developed alongside reopening doctrines and has always been asserted as an alternative theory. So if much of this court's unpublished case law deals with the omitted asset doctrine as an alternative to allegations of fraud on the court under Miranda or as an alternative to reopening under 1452. But what it makes clear is that a party need not satisfy that higher standard, whether the Miranda standard or the statutory 518.145 standard, to deal with something that simply wasn't dealt with, to address an issue that the party simply overlooked. I see my time has expired. So with that, appellant respectfully seeks reversal to the district court to implement the property division required by the decree.
Thank you. We'll return now, turn now to respondent counsel.
Thank you. May it please the court, John Lilly for respondent Graham Pooley. Judge Werke, I think you hit the nail on the head with this comes down to credibility, believability. It's simply not that an asset's omitted, and so therefore it's omitted that now 6 years later we're going to return and divide these as if we would if those assets were litigated. I think the court, and I tried to outline it in my brief, needs to have the understanding of the context of how this divorce came about. And how this divorce came about is, and this is undisputed as well, is after a 23-year marriage, appellant told respondent and their teenage daughter she's leaving on a week's notice to move 1,000 miles away to Kentucky, ending a 23-year marriage. And we have to look at the context of that, the context of this agreement. That's what was argued before the district court as well, was that in order to believe appellant's argument, you have to believe that respondent, after being told that, after being distraught, agreed to assume all marital debts, including a hardship loan, credit card debt, agreed to maintain the marital home for 14 months originally, but it turned out to be 22 months in its entirety, making all costs, making all repairs, ensuring that asset would retain its valuability to be divided equally, agreed to, unfortunately, they realized after the fact, which happens with a lot of pro se parties, he initially agreed to pay appellant's health insurance for an additional 6 months. That wasn't able to be accomplished, but it was part of their agreement, and took on all these debts and all these assets, but then was going to agree to divide all his assets equally.
But Mr. Lilly, I mean, those amounts pale in comparison to the value of his 401k and his pension, right? I mean, those are what we're talking about there are amounts that are five-figure amounts, probably less. You know, I understand he spent $50,000 to improve the house, but the other amounts are really, I mean, they don't amount to the same thing, do they?
They don't, Your Honor, but they don't have to. As the court's well aware, divorces are supposed to be equitable, not equal. And that's an appellant in their brief attaches a real short transcript from the district court hearing. And respondent respectfully agreed with the court. We equitably divided this. You need the context of this agreement. They're two pro se people. They don't have the advice of a counsel. But I can't imagine, if you look at logic and reason and credibility and believably, and as Judge Werke indicated, the district court made a credibility determination. There's several allegations that appellant made in her motion to the court that were proven to be material misrepresentations.
And just
just
to be clear, I mean, the district court made its findings based solely on, or almost entirely based on affidavits, correct?
Correct.
Three affidavits by Ms. Pooley, one affidavit by Mr. Pooley. And then I believe that Ms. Pooley spoke at the hearing briefly without being sworn.
She did, Your Honor. She spoke briefly. It was mostly on affidavits. But then that leads into the point I was trying to make, Your Honor, which is that her claim and her testimony at the contested hearing was that she had been diligently trying to recover these retirement assets basically from the day of divorce. However, we have zero documents that support her claims.
Well, we have a lot of documents from 3M. 3M sent her a lot of documents about how to get a quadro, right? I mean, after the fact,
Your Honor, but we don't have one email or one correspondence from any time dated from the date of this divorce going forward that that says, boy, you need to get a clarification from the district court, or you need to have respondent sign off on these documents. She provided not one document that indicates any correspondence, any attempts whatsoever. We have two different conversations in time, and I put to the court the one that's most important is the text message exchange between the parties when Mr. Pooley reached out to Ms. Pooley regarding the additional cost he had to incur for an additional 8 months in maintaining the home, and he simply requested some additional money out of the home equity in response to having to incur additional expenses. And if you believe Ms. Pooley's argument that it was the clear intention of the parties to equally divide these retirement assets, and then she had been diligently pursuing it for the past 24 months, and that Mr. Pooley had been frustrating that process through a variety of different reasons she gives, look at that text message exchange. He asked for it. Ms. Pooley's response is simply, we sat down, we agreed to this, we agree to be bound by it. I don't know how it's believable or credible or rational or logical that someone who thought and states now under oath that their agreement was specifically to divide these retirement assets and had been diligently pursuing it for 24 months, the immediate response on someone such as that would be believable or credible would be, wait a minute, you want an extra $5,000 or $6,000 out of the equity of the home? I'm entitled to over $100,000 in your 401k that I've been diligently trying to get for the last 2 years. But that's not a response. Her response is simply, we agreed to this, we sat down, we signed it, we're bound by it. And I think that gives the context of what I started out in my argument about, looking at the context of this whole agreement. She left to go to Kentucky and left this marriage and left their teenage daughter with the respondent 1 week after she told them that that's what she was going to do. Now, I assume she regrets that decision. Now she's trying to come back and reopen this decree. But the clarity and the clarification, we look at it, and Judge Werke referenced it, where it says, it talks about assets such as boats, cars, jewelry, furniture, and whatnot. And right underneath that, it says, we will be split equally. We'll work together. But then specifically, the language says you need to attach asset sheet A, which they did. And husband and wife agreed to divide their marital property as listed by them in attachment A. Everything is listed other than two things, retirement accounts and life insurance.
Well, so then and other assets. Other assets is a column two, and there's nothing there.
Correct.
So actually you've got the retirement accounts, the life insurance, and other assets.
Correct. You are correct, Your Honor. And that then takes us to the context of looking at this whole agreement. If you want to take appellate's argument on its face, you're going to say that he was distraught by this divorce. The marriage ended on a week's notice, but he agreed to take on all this debt. And to Judge Johnson's point, is it equal in the amount of debt he took on? No, it's not. But he's under no obligation to. And so then you have to look at the intent of the parties. You look at the credibility, which is what the district court did. Why would he take on any and all medical and health insurance for their minor daughter? Why would he agree to be solely responsible for that $12,000 401k hardship loan? Why would he agree to take on that credit card debt and do all those things and then still divide his retirement assets equally? It doesn't make sense. Basically, he'd be responsible for any and all debt and any and all obligation, and then at the same time giving up all assets for someone who clearly didn't want this relationship to end, was clearly distraught, was clearly upset.
Mr. Lilly?
Yes.
Another question. So the district court found, in essence, in short, that the parties intentionally agreed to not list the retirement assets on attachment A. I mean, is that even proper? In other words, are people permitted to do that? If you're filing a joint petition with the court, isn't there a requirement that the petition must list all marital assets and that to withhold them is it permissible for parties to withhold and to basically make a representation that this is all we got when it's just not true?
Your Honor, I would say if it was a material misrepresentation, that would be accurate. But the problem here is that neither party claims that this was a mistake to not list these retirement assets. Ms. Pooley is not claiming that this document was altered in any way, that at one time they were filled in and then left. They were under the mistaken belief that they didn't have to include them. And Mr. Pooley addressed it in his affidavit at district court.
So it is a mistaken belief. I mean, you're agreeing with me that parties are not permitted to do that.
Your Honor, I don't know for certain what the law states with regards. I would tell the court that what they testified to is they left it out intentionally. And that was one of my arguments in my brief about there's a case that cites to an unintentional. There's no evidence that they claim that they didn't know about these assets and that they were, you know, mistakenly left out. They intended to leave them out. And I think that's one of the problems we have with pre-printed divorce forms and one of the problems we have with pro se parties trying to settle a divorce after a marriage of over 23 years, accumulating multiple assets. But what the indication here is, in order to believe appellant's argument, we have to somehow infer that there was an intention to divide those assets. And then I go back to the specific language to divide their marital property as listed by them in attachment A. They were not listed. And there's no evidence other than appellant specific verbal assertions that she had done anything other than file this motion almost 6 years after the fact. There's nothing in the only written agreements we have, or the only written correspondence we have after the divorce, is specifically related to that. And then I put to the court, go back to the believability and credibility on appellant's motion. One of the claims was, I didn't have the money to bring this till then. But she doesn't refute the fact that she got $36,000 2 years after the fact. That flies in the face of logic and credibility and believability. The courts are always...
Mr. Lilly, I'm sorry to keep interrupting you, but you do have a tendency to continue talking and giving answers that have no end. And so that's why I continue to interrupt you. Mr. Brillette made the argument that nobody argued to the district court that the document is ambiguous. Do you agree with that?
Correct.
Okay. Did you argue that it was unambiguous?
I believe I did, Your Honor. I, like I said, my argument, and specifically when you look to that part of the agreement, division of marital property, right above where it lists, will we split equally, work together, it lists all sorts of fungible things, real estate, personal property, tangible things. Then when you go down to the asset sheet where it talks about potential finances, it said what we intend to divide will be listed in here. It's specifically not listed in there. Mr. Pooley in his affidavit submitted as such that it was their intent to leave it out because it would be cleaner. When you look at that total asset division, it's a miracle that somehow they each come down with $24,500. That's because two pro se people created this agreement. In a perfect world, would they have listed these assets? Yes, they would have. And he would have kept his and she would have kept hers. But I keep going back to the credibility determination because we don't have anything else. The court's looking at this document, trying to figure out how we're going to resolve this dispute. And there were several false representations made by appellant that were shown not to be true. One of them, which is relevant in the whole context of interpreting this agreement, is claiming that respondent somehow stole her money. That required their now adult daughter to submit an affidavit saying no. My mother transferred $14,000 into my account and $3,000 into my father's account. And unbeknownst to us, several days later, we heard from the boyfriend that she had attempted suicide. That money was put in there. That was not an issue we intended to raise in any level, but it was appellant made it in her motion paperwork alleging the respondent stole this money, somehow trying to, I don't know, turn the court against him for some sort of alleged bad act. We find out that wasn't the case. And so it goes to the context of this agreement. She ended a 23 marriage on 1 week's notice and moved to Kentucky, leaving respondent and their teenage daughter alone. I put to the court that it's not believable or credible that he would agree to assume all those debts, even if they're not equal, and in exchange for agreeing to then divide all the assets. When you look at the credibility, every assertion he's made has been supported by at least some documentation, but for her claims that simply this is what we intended, she's got no evidentiary support to support those documents. I think when you look at this, I think fraud should apply. It's not simply that asset was omitted, and therefore if an asset's omitted, we simply are going to divide it the way we were if it was litigated. There has to be some sort of evidentiary support to show that that was omitted, and it was omitted in error, not intentionally omitted. And I don't believe there's facts to support that. Therefore, I would ask the court to uphold the district court's ruling. Thank you.
Thank you. And Mr. Boulette, you have the last word. 5 minutes is on the time clock.
Thank you, Your Honor. There's a significant number of inflammatory facts in respondent's submission to the district court, and respondent's brief, and respondent's arguments here. But there's a significant concession which makes all of that irrelevant, which is we are not looking at an ambiguous document according to respondent, according to appellant, or according to the district court. Because this isn't an ambiguous document, there's no fact-finding to be done. In fact, the vast majority of the facts that respondent wrote and the district court adopted nearly verbatim are entirely irrelevant. What the court was asked to do is look at the words on the page and say, what do the words on the page tell us about the parties intent?
I have to stop you right there because this is a really simple-minded question, but you know, you're saying it's not ambiguous, and Mr. Lilly is saying it's not ambiguous. Are we empowered as appellate court to do, you haven't raised that issue. Nobody's claiming it's unambiguous. Can we even get there under any mechanism if we so intended? De novo review is one thing, but these are things you didn't argue.
I tend to agree with you, Your Honor. I think that, yes, it's an issue that's subject to de novo review, but where both parties acknowledge that the words on the page should be taken at face value and there's no construction required, that to engage in the act of construction by itself is error. And I think that's where we see the district court's principal error is Mr. Lilly's acknowledging this is an unambiguous document. District court counsel for Ms. Pooley is arguing this is an unambiguous document. And yet the district court blows past this question of ambiguity and proceeds to apply construction to a document that doesn't require any.
Let's say if respondent says it's unambiguous, that doesn't necessarily mean respondent agrees with appellant's interpretation of the document. Appellant and respondent could have two different interpretations of what they say is an unambiguous document. And I might have a third point of view, which is somewhere in the middle, which is that it's ambiguous and it does require that there's no possible way to come to any single meaning based upon the words that were used and the information that's absent.
Right. And I would agree with you, Judge Johnson. Certainly the district court could have said both parties are arguing for a different construction that they argue is unambiguous, and I find ambiguity, and here's why I find it. Similar to a situation where both parties argue for summary judgment, and the court says, I get that neither of you see a genuine issue of material fact, but I do, and here's where I see them. However, the district court actually in its own language tells us, I don't see this as a document requiring clarification either. What I think is significant, though, is Judge Johnson, unlike a traditional contract case, where I think you'd be absolutely right, I have to choose between an unambiguous construction, an ambiguous a finding of ambiguity, which required me to engage in construction, there was a third alternative to the district court here, which is to find the language in on its face is unambiguous. It unambiguously divides the property equally, but it also unambiguously excludes marital or retirement assets. And that's when I resort to Brink and Searles and Steele and say, I have reserved jurisdiction. Now we have to equitably divide these omitted marital assets. And so it had available to it an option that many courts engaged in contract interpretation don't normally have. What I think is particularly notable, though, and I want this court to end on, is that counsel's argument for intent doesn't have a basis in the words on the page. And whether we're doing construction as a matter of plain language or whether we're looking to extrinsic evidence, we still have to make sense of the words on the page. And what the words on the page undoubtedly do not say here is that Mr. Pooley gets 100% of the retirement that was saved over 25 years of marriage. There's nothing anywhere in this document that says he takes 100% of, in essence, the marital retirement. Mr. Pooley argues that, well, I wouldn't have done that, but for these other provisions, but for taking $3,200 in credit card debt, but for paying the mortgage on the house that I live in, pending sale. But there's a way to make sense of the words on the page that also makes sense of those concessions without needing to imagine whole separate side agreements into existence. At the time of the divorce, Mr. Pooley was making $75,000 a year. Ms. Pooley was on disability and employed part-time making $8,000 a year. Notwithstanding that, she waived spousal maintenance, and the waiver in the document says that the property division is consideration for the waiver of maintenance. So to the extent we have to make sense, or the court needed to make sense, of some of these provisions that appear to put more of the onus on Mr. Pooley, they're accounted for in the language of the document itself by looking at the maintenance waiver. Ms. Pooley respectfully asks that this court reverse. Thank you.
Thank you to each of you for appearing in our Zoom calendar. This matter is submitted, and a decision will be issued within the statutory timeframe.